Monster Man, Special Episode, Technological Terrors.
Hello and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the gaming books of yesteryear. And as I do, I'm talking about the monsters that I find in them. Their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games.
Today's episode is a special episode, brought to you by the generosity and public spirit of my Patreon backers. And in particular, of Patreon backer Rafe. If you'd like to be like Rafe and choose your own special episode, all you gotta do is go to patreon.com/monsterman and pledge at the $5 level. And if you do that, you'll also get access to the rewards for other levels, including all new episodes of my other podcast, Patron Deities. So Rafe, thank you very much for your support, and I hope that you enjoyed today's episode. Rafe has asked me to talk about technological terrors, mechanical monsters, all that kind of thing, and in particular, how they differ from magical monsters, especially in a high fantasy setting like your conventional D&D. And mechanical monsters are a feature of many D&D scenarios, indeed from quite early on in the game, whether that's the science fiction creatures of Expedition to the Barrier Peaks, right? Obviously you've got sort of alien creatures, but you also have robots and other mechanical threats, the mobile fortress from the scenario Earthshaker, or various machines and androids that we've seen in sources like the Creature Catalog. One of the earliest impulses of people running D&D seems to have been to add science fiction elements to it. I think I once summarized like the three main threads of fan articles about early D&D as armor class doesn't make a lot of sense, spell memorization doesn't make a lot of sense, and let's get some laser guns up ins. So technology plays a role in a lot of these fantasy adventures, but to what extent is that technology really differentiable from magic? I wanted to do this entire episode without mentioning Clark's Law, but I don't think that I can, right? Arthur C. Clarke famously said, any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. And I think we can debate how true that is, but in D&D, it is definitely true on one level, which is that magic and technology are typically mechanically indistinguishable. A fireball and a grenade, a scorching ray and a laser beam. I mean, these exist within the limits that mechanics create. They have a range, a save, an amount of damage they do. The system expresses all these things using the same kind of standardized ideas, and consequently, there isn't very much difference between a grenade and a fireball, except that anybody can throw a grenade, whereas only someone who can do magic can throw a fireball. So maybe it's the accessibility that makes the difference? I'm not sure. You can actually see this with most rules for even like post-medieval technology that are added to the game, like in addition to its kind of default level of medieval technology. For example, most rules for guns really struggle to make them all that different from bows and arrows, because bow and arrow is just like a medieval skin on the idea of non-magical projectile weapon. In gameplay terms, few games effectively differentiate technology and magic, right? They produce similar systems of specialization, similar systems of resource management, and typically technology winds up being like a feature of a particular class, some kind of mechanical ability that a certain gimmick has, rather than something that anybody can learn to do. And consequently, they don't, in mechanical or in play procedural terms, feel very different from each other. Now, a thought for the future, I don't know if we're going to cover this in this episode. Is that because technology in traditional fantasy games doesn't feel technological? Or is it because magic doesn't feel magical? It doesn't feel weird or exotic. It feels, you know, using a message spell feels like making a phone call. How does this relate to some real-world technology that feels kind of magical to us? I think for a lot of us, certain types of technology, maybe many types of technology, feel like wondrous things whose workings are understood only by an arcane sect of initiates, rather than things that are accessible to everybody, even if in the strictest sense they are. So the difference between magical and technological things, magical and technological monsters in fantasy games, is not mechanical, it's not in play, it's not sort of procedural, it's aesthetic. It is a difference of feel, it's a difference of meaning, and I think a lot has to do with how things are presented. How does it feel? What does it mean to have a mechanical monster? And I think that the qualities of the mechanical monster are threefold. First, it is impersonal. The terrors of the machine age are anonymous. The assembly line, the firing line, the grinding teeth of the factory. The bullet sprayed by the machine gun doesn't have your name on it. It just says, to whom it may concern. The dawn of, like, the events that give us our sense of technological horror, they're all about mass movements, about mass, you know, employees in factories during the Industrial Revolution, about massed soldiers during conflicts like the First and Second World Wars. All of those kinds of visions of industrializations are either impersonal or kind of like collectivistic. The mechanical monster doesn't have a name or a personality, and it doesn't care about your name or personality. Part of the horror of the, well, and we'll get to this later when we talk about anxiety versus technology, but part of the horror of the mechanical monster, the horror of the machine age, is the idea that the unique and delicate human identity is reduced to being perceived like a part in a machine. We're all just cogs. This could mean one massive, complex beast like Earthshaker, which is not automated, it has a crew, but you know what I mean. It could be some kind of legion of identical copies. That idea of being identical is something that we associate with machines. And again, this works well with the idea of exploring the ruins of a lost civilization, right? Like, you're running into systems that were intended to do something and are continuing to do it, even though it's no longer applicable. They're not smart enough to do anything different. This idea of impersonality can verge on an idea of soullessness or inhumanity, right? So, I mean, you could think about the way, for instance, that the Terminator is presented in the first film. If you listen to, like, Kyle Reese's dialogue, he talks about the Terminator being, like, tireless, pitiless. Those aren't things that are terribly threatening in a fantasy adventure game rather than like a chase thriller like Terminator, because very few enemies are expected to have pity. Second, predictability. Machines are supposed to function logically. An automated system is a set of rules that are put into action. Maybe a very complicated set of rules, but it is a set of rules. A magical creature can care about emotions, it can care about symbols, it can act chaotically, but a machine has rules, not feelings. And players are going to want to observe and learn and manipulate those rules, right? Figure out those inputs and outputs, and they should be able to. One of the things that is a feature of mechanical monsters is that they often have observable behavior patterns, which makes sense because that's kind of how machines behave. Put in the same input, get the same output. A machine is something that works the same way for everybody, which is another feature of its impersonality. It also suggests some of the appeal of the machine. And maybe this is a myth, right? Well, as we can see with the way that like AI can incorporate the biases of its creators. But the myth of the machine is that because it's not affected by human emotion, then it's not affected by human bias or prejudice. You can be assessed by a machine in a way that's objective, whereas a human might be judging you based on like social traits that they like or don't like. The numbers don't lie. So there are kind of like advantages. You can see what the appeal is. A machine doesn't care about your name or your identity, which would be a bad thing if you thought that your name or identity were always advantages, but maybe they're not. That's a side note. My main point here is that players are going to want to use those rules. They're going to want to hack the machine. They're going to want to change the program. They're going to want to use the program to avoid or defeat it, and that should be part of the game. Because otherwise, is just a big monster to fight. It doesn't have to be a machine. Now, having said that, one of the dangers of machine monsters like this is painting your own NPCs as dummies. This is a hard line to walk. It happens with magical puzzles as well, right? In D&D, frequently you run into like a puzzle that is the key to getting into the Lost Tower or, you know, disempowering Dark Lord Zergithrax or whatever. And no one has been in there for centuries, but, you know, five university students can solve it in about 20 minutes. That's a gameplay necessity, but then you sort of like, oh, it was actually pretty easy. I don't know why, you know, the king and all his wise men had such a hard time getting into it. This is the Star Trek problem, right? Like, everybody's got a problem that Captain Kirk can solve in 45 minutes. Kind of weird that they couldn't solve it themselves. But it's just, you know, it's an unfortunate consequence of the format, but what are you going to do? You have to balance it quite carefully. You know, you have to find that balancing point, and sometimes you won't, and, you know, that's okay. Third, machine monsters represent anxieties about technology. You know, monsters in general often represent fears, and mechanical monsters specifically represent fears about technology, right? That makes sense. About the way it overwhelms us, the way it doesn't care about us, the way it can replace us. Now, I'm not saying that monsters, you know, I said represent. Monsters don't represent those fears in a kind of like one-to-one correspondence. They just remind us of those fears or make us think of those fears. You know, sometimes you get a monster that is very clearly intended to evoke a specific societal fear. And I think that for the most part, those don't actually work super well. You want a monster that makes you think of a thing you're afraid of, rather than just like being a stand-in for a thing you're afraid of. There are exceptions. For all the people make fun of George Lucas, the monster should rhyme with the thing, right? But this is another one of those things where the anxiety that the monsters play on is an anxiety that the players, or at least the society that the players are part of, have, not the characters, right? In a typical pseudo-medieval fantasy world, mechanization isn't something that people are really going to be concerned about. And even if you are playing in a kind of industrial revolution world where, you know, weavers are being put out of business and, you know, farm laborers are being replaced by some kind of automated threshing machines or what have you, all of those things that happen in the real world, but very few people are building like automated dungeon explorers. That's true of a lot of contemporary fears. You know, we have monsters that are based on the sort of serial killer archetypes, not really a feature of folklore mythology. We have monsters that represent our fears about the environment. We have monsters that represent our fears about totalitarianism. We have monsters that represent our fears about technology. Sure. Again, perhaps not always in a directly one-to-one way. But so you want to think about and evoke what it is that the players feel about this thing that you want the monster to address. Or not even address, but just kind of like remind them of. So if these are the qualities of the mechanical monster, how then do we incorporate those into games? I would posit that there are three main types of mechanical monster. Although there are variations and, you know, there are lots of other examples, but I think that, you know, a lot of them fall into three rough categories. The first is the mechanical monstrosity. So Earthshaker is an example of this, or maybe even the Juggernauts, right? Those big war machines from the Master of the Desert Nomads. They're representations of power. In the case of Earthshaker, also of complexity, Earthshaker makes me think of, is it called The Moving Fortress, which is a graphic novel? I want to say, I don't know who wrote it. I want to say the art is by Enrique Alcatena, which is this kind of like weird ritual industrialized kind of thing, very kind of proto-Warhammer-y. I'm sure I've spoken about The Moving Fortress before on this podcast. You know, some kind of giant machine that grinds across the landscape, perhaps, you know, doing what it's meant to do, perhaps once designed to like mine resources or terraform a planet or something like that, right? You know, maybe it was abandoned by its creators or it's even outlived them. Obviously, the Juggernauts don't fall into that. They're basically just tanks. But I like this idea because the mindlessness and the impersonality mean that it's not like a Tarrasque or Godzilla or something. It's just like a big device. So the idea that you could like get in there and hack it makes sense. You could send a team aboard a huge terraforming, what's that novel with the big mortal engines with the rolling cities? You know, you could send a team aboard there to try and disable it in a way that you couldn't do with Godzilla, or you couldn't do with a horde of enemies. The massive scale is important. I was thinking about this in terms of the Mark IV Warbot from Paranoia, which appears in scenarios like Me and My Shadow Mark IV or Alpha Complexities, where it's basically this, it's Ogre, right? It's the Ogre from Steve Jackson Games' Ogre. It's a, you know, an enormous tank with a kind of humanoid torso on it, at least in Alpha Complexities. And in Me and My Shadow Mark IV, it's presented as this kind of like baffling complexity. Like one of the sub scenarios is just called Something Falls Off. So, you know, you're supposed to be guarding the Mark IV Warbot, right? Like six Jokers with pistols guarding this enormously deadly monster robot. And at one point, something falls off. And you basically just have to decide whether you're going to, like, find someone to blame, try to put it back on, just like, kick it under the robot and claim it fell off before you got there, etc. And Alpha Complexities, it has a bunch of people living inside it whose society is like a weird inverted parody of Alpha Complex. But there, like, the scale is important, the way in which the scale of technology dwarfs the human. Next, you got your Robot Legion. This is a pulp staple, right? A horde of faceless, regimented enemies controlled by some kind of central computer or mad inventor. In a way, Robot Legions represent our fears of, like, oh, totalitarianism is going to brainwash our enemies, technology is going to give one madman the power to destroy us all, right, to amplify his force. And of course, they reflect, like, a pretty common perception in wartime, where we're privy to our own interiority and our own conflicts and whatever, but we perceive our enemy as a homogeneous mechanized mass, right? It's also popular in the action-adventure genre because it allows heroes to just zap a bunch of enemies without having to engage with the moral consequences of, like, killing a human being. An obvious example of this would be Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, where in the cartoon adaptation of the comic, the baddies were turned into robots and given a more, like, grotesque and exaggerated appearance to emphasize that fact, whereas in the comic, they're just dudes. And it's just the case that, like, these fun, lovable turtle characters are hacking people apart with swords, which obviously you couldn't have in a kid's cartoon. So there's a horror in the faceless mechanical legion, but there's also an opportunity. This also reflects, like, this kind of goes a little bit into the next one, because Robot Legion makes us think about the ways in which militaries dehumanize the people who are in them. They take away elements of their individuality. You know, they wear uniforms. They have standardized haircuts. You know, they have less individual freedom and agency than civilians do, right? They're supposed to do what they're told. And there's that fear that what they are trying to do is make that person like a robot. That the ideal soldier would be someone who didn't have moral qualms about violence or didn't have their own ideas about what is best to be done rather than just following the orders of their superiors. I think there's a fear of the loss of identity there. And that goes to my next point, which is the idea of the synthetic human, right? So think about, like, creatures like the doppelganger. They exploit our fear of having our identity subverted. But at least the doppelganger is an imposter, right? It's a creature in some ways like us. It's not some kind of synthetic duplicate. If we can be replaced by androids, if we can be replaced by such a thing, well, what does that say about us? It's about attacking the sense of humanity in the living by demonstrating the artificial version of them. Again, that plays with modern anxieties that relate to artificiality and the difference between the representation and the thing represented. But I think that it can work as a monster. Again, I just think there's a difference, you know, when you uncover the scheme between, like, it turning out to be, you know, a shapeshifted hag who cackles at you and teleports away, and it turning out to be some imitation. You know, you have to wonder about Nick Fury. Like, the number of times Nick Fury dies and it turns out to have been a life model decoy, that man must have a pretty bland personality if he's constantly being accurately mimicked to people who know him by robots. Now, in all of these, I've kind of focused on the horror of these creatures, like what is oppressive and frightening about them, but there's a version of this that's played for comedy, because it's a little bit like the analogy that I mentioned earlier about military life, right? Like, I have never been in the military, but just based on the words and writings of people who have, for a lot of people, the rigorous rules of military life coming up against the folly and vagary of human nature produce situations that are as often absurd as they are tragic. That when unpredictable humans meet inflexible systems and rules, the result is often actually comedy. That's the paranoia comedy, right? Where in the game Paranoia, you live in a world that's full of extremely strict but not very sensible rules, and the interaction of those rules and the, you know, people who have to live with them produces the humor. That and, like, a bunch of slapstick. But there's also kind of so that's kind of like the Brazil version of this, I guess, but there's also the sort of gnomish version of this, where the people who can create technology in a fantasy world may not be these kinds of, like, remorseless capitalists. They may be our kind of, like, whimsical Rube Goldberg read on those capitalists. It's all the same stuff. It's all the same ideas of systems that don't take into account, you know, human logic, or machines that just do what they were designed to do and don't have any common sense or discrimination about it. but played for comedy. So you could have a dungeon that was just like the factory of a gnomish inventor, and it was just all completely out of control. You know, here you are fighting the cleaning robots that just think that, you know, all non-gnomish biological life is algae, and they're running around trying to scare you off with acid and lasers, and you're on like a conveyor belt being wheeled through a bunch of, you know, big smushers on your way to the blast furnace while Carl Stalling and the Warner Brothers Orchestra play a jaunty tune. And that kind of Charlie Chaplin robo-rally version of technological terror, I think, you know, it exists in the same space of meaning as the more horrifying and oppressive ones, right? It exists in the same space of meaning as Skynet. But it's based on a view that's more focused on like the foibles of human nature. So it's not like hubris, where these people created something that would destroy them, thinking that they could control it, or where the force multiplier of technology has put, you know, limitless power in the hands of a single evildoer, right? That's the kind of like every video game ever where some non-specific terrorist has a dirty bomb. It's about how technology magnifies folly. So instead of that technology multiplying the power of an evil person, it's multiplying the power of a goofball. And, you know, I think that has a place as well. There are dungeons that are based around that idea, because large organized systems always have this kind of element of absurdity to them, and that absurdity can go toward a kind of black comedy, or can go in the direction of whimsy. So I'm sorry, I got sidetracked on comedy. Humorous gaming is on my mind lately. Like I said that thing earlier about how games in general tend to be funny, but published games tend not to be. I've been thinking about it. But anyway, my point is simply that there are multiple ways to interpret these ideas. They can be horrifying, but they can also be absurd. And there's actually not a very great distance between the two. But either way, that is all the mechanical monsters that I've got time to talk about today. Rafe, thank you very much for your support, and I hope that you enjoyed this episode. Once again, everyone else, if you'd like to be like Rafe and get your own special episode, all you gotta do is go to patreon.com/monsterman and pledge at the $5 level. In our next episode, we're going to be returning to Monstrous Manual, the 1993 supplement for Advanced Dungeons & Dragons 2nd Edition. After that, we'll have a new episode of Patron Deities for my $2 and up subscribers, where we talk about some of the other deities of the Tengrist Pantheon, followed by another Patron Request episode. And so I hope that you will join me for all of these, right here on Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great. Thank you for listening.
If you have a favorite monster or something you'd like me to talk about, you can reach me on Twitter at GonzoHistory or by email, gonzohistory@gmail.com. To support Monster Man, just go to patreon.com/monsterman. Thank you to Ray Otis for designing the thumbnail image. Our introductory music is Solve the Damn Mystery by Jesse Spillane from the album Descent of the Goober Monster, used under a Creative Commons Attribution License. Thank you again for listening, and please join us next time.